It's the Dev Friday Show with Mark and Tim.
I mean, feels... I love it. I love it. You got some coffee there, Mark? Yeah, it feels a little early, doesn't it? Doesn't it? 8:50 on a Friday. Like, I feel like there's going to be a slightly different aspect to the show. This isn't two developers kicking it back after a week of work. This is two developers talking before they start the last day of the week of work or something
two,
like that.
It's two developers before they wake up, Tim. I don't know how interesting this is going to be. All right, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, you feel like you're a little bit... I think I told you your mic was fine, but I feel like you're a little far from your mic right there.
I'm moving up here.
Yeah, it's a little... I feel like we got... I mean, that's the one complaint that we had from our listeners last time I talked to a human in-person listener.
The one listener.
I think there were two. It was two people at PHP Tech. I believe they both admitted that they listened to this show. Now, they haven't listened recently, and I think we know why they haven't listened recently. That's because I haven't actually published any of our shows recently, and that's probably a problem that I should figure out how to fix. But I've got them all mixed down. I just haven't run them through the AI thing to get the summaries built. And I don't know, because we've talked about so much AWS stuff in my mind, what I want to do, and I'm not going to get to it this time, so I'm just going to run it manually. But in my mind, I'm thinking, I drop these files basically have a mix of the show. That's what you would listen to. They have Mark's channel of audio and my channel of audio. And then if I drop them into an S3 bucket, I should be able to have a Lambda function or something trigger. And that would run Sox, because I need to... Have you ever used Sox?
I have not.
Sox is like the command line audio. I think they actually call themselves like the Swiss Army knife of audio or something like that. It's the command line audio... I don't know what you want to call it. Does everything, right? And you can tell Sox... Think of it as like FFmpeg for audio. And you can tell Sox, take this channel, you know, take the Mark channel and take the Tim channel and combine them into one stereo channel. And then I take that stereo file and I pass it off to the transcription API and I say, hey, transcribe this. And then after a while, it has a callback, or I can just pull it and see that it has a transcription. And once I have the transcription ID, I can say, hey, summarize this. So I feel like some of those things could be Lambda functions that would take the two audios, make them a stereo file, another one would submit it, something have to watch that job. Maybe when the transcription comes in, we might as well save it as a text file in the same folder, then using some predetermined prompts, ask it to summarize it. And then if the summary goes into that folder, and we just make like a JSON file with the summary or something like that, I mean, we could have a trigger then say, oh, grab the fragment of JSON from that summary and throw it into some, like, whatever we basically call our RSS feed, you know, or whatever powers the site, and then basically we're there, right?
You know, with AWS, Tim.
Yeah?
Pretty much you have everything.
Yeah.
All you need is a YAML file and a Lambda function. You got it.
Not a sponsor.
It's that simple.
not a sponsor.
Oh. We could consider this like the worst AWS podcast that exists. I could go with that title. Maybe we should rename the show instead of Dev Friday.
I think
the worst AWS podcast. We would actually probably get a good following. I feel like
this is a good subtitle. Dev Friday, the worst AWS podcast.
Yeah.
We have been talking about it. It used to be the worst AI podcast. Now it's the worst AWS podcast. Speaking of AI, glad you brought that up. I was playing with AWS and doing some fun stuff with like Cognito. I'm sure you've played with Cognito. Yeah.
Yeah.
To do like a login for a really simple concept.
Many hate it, but yes.
Oh, what? Okay. let's delve into that.
I'm not an expert of it. I did roll a single sign-on solution for Cognito, mostly for an administrative interface, just to make it kind of easy using a like the Google account. You know, because it has that federated functionality, so you can use like your Google account, your Microsoft account, your GitHub account, and then you can, Cognito will use it as a provider to authenticate you. It was fine for me. It was fine for my purposes. We are using it internally in our company, but actually, it's interesting. We're using it in very kind of small ways. I haven't touched it yet, but I think in the future, though. Oh, actually, well, maybe we could talk about that. Like I said, I was thinking about, like, going to the show, how much can I talk about What can I talk about? If I do talk about things, how do I talk about them now?
Yeah.
I really filter myself, and I'm not used to this, Tim.
No, you're not.
It's
no, you're not.
Very uncomfortable.
I was going
to
say.
You know how I like to live my life. It's very an unfiltered life, but when
also
it comes
feels
to...
like without a great internet connection is where you're like living your life right now. Because is your VPN on?
Oh, interesting. I am running through not a VPN, but a service called, I don't even know. Here, I'm going to actually exit out of it. Zscaler.
What now?
It's one of those, where all of your internet filters through another company and tracks it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But since I am basically on a DevOps admin, so I can just turn that off. So
all right. There.
Hopefully that'll help.
it feels like it might be a little bit better. A couple things. Okay, so we're going a couple different directions here. One thing I did want to mention is, and we lost Mark. Let me put him back on here. All right. And yep, now you're back. Now you're back. I think it blipped enough. That must have reset enough internet that Restream was like, he must be gone. So you're back, right?
Yep.
You can hear me? All right. With the change to the new job, new workflow, mm-hmm. I was curious as to, and maybe we can just get to this later because I want to go back to Cognito for a second. But how your office has changed, like that environment, your work environment, because it's got to be completely different going back to more regular development from say teaching. It's way different, I'm sure, mm-hmm. kind of set of needs. And that resonates with me because, you know, as I used to be on the road more doing DevRel style stuff, I'd program on my laptop and just be fine. Now you ask me to do that, I'd be like, please no. Let me just go back to my computer where I've got all five screens and I can bounce. You know, you want me to just type code into a single? No, I can't. No, I mean I can, but I don't want to. It's like the difference for those who grew up on, you know, PBS shows on the weekends, right? You'd have Norm Abrams. Who did you ever watch the New Yankee Workshop? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have Norm Abrams.
Norm Abrams, yeah.
He'd take it. He's on this old house too, but New Yankee Workshop. He'd show you how to build all this stuff, and he'd have every tool that you could have. And then there'd be this other guy. I forget what he was called, but he'd be like the guy that went out into the woods, and he didn't have a drill. But it was like a bow that he was using to run a bit through, and like those two different fields. It's like yeah, I could do it with hand tools, but come on, I'm gonna sit down at my desk with my five screens. So I'm curious to see how your setup has changed since since the job switch. But let's go back to Cognito. You used it.
Well, you're just jumping all over the place.
I want to put it in your mind. We'll
this
come
is
back.
What happens
we'll
when
come
you
back
try to do
that.
A show at we'll 9 a.m. the morning. It's like, I can barely talk because I'm not awake. And you're just like jumping from one thing to the next. You're like, you're wired.
We'll come back to that. Oh, that's another good point, though. Like, so coffee, is that what you need in the morning?
Yes, I try not to have it first thing in the morning because that's what I've read.
Really?
Try to like wait like a good, you know, definitely at least an hour after you wake up, possibly even 2 hours, because it actually helps you. Your body becomes too dependent on it as it cycles in the morning.
Oh, okay.
So once you wake up, you know, if you have just water, that's what I try to do, just drink water when I first thing when I wake up. And I do, I was actually went to the gym this morning, did a 30 minute at the gym. So, and
nice.
Then, so I try to have coffee like usually around, let's see, what is it? 9 o'clock. Usually I should try to go like around 9:30, 10 o'clock. So,
okay,
yeah,
so we're
since
pushing,
we're doing this
we're,
early, I'm pushing
you,
Tim.
I'm pushing you a little early today. All right. So, we're all over the place. And I think that's the content people come for. But back to Cognito. You used it because of the single sign-in. My mm-hmm. use case is just, I don't want to build a login form for a really simple thing.
Yeah.
I want someone else to handle it because, it's like, oh, how hard is login? Right. You hash the password because you're not storing the password, which also all you people who say my password can't be more than 20 characters long, what are you doing and why do you care? But that's it.
How hard is the login? That's a typical junior developer question.
Right.
Oh,
right.
I can just roll my own auth and how hard is that to do?
Not even saying rolling your own auth. I'm saying like using libraries, like using accepted mm-hmm. Hashing libraries to, and yeah. then comparing, because PHP's got a bunch of those that are like, no, this is the way you do password authentication. Great, we did it. And then it's like, yes, very simple. It's just a username and a password and a form. But what if they forget their password? Oh, now we have to build a password reset. Okay, yeah, right. How long do they stay logged in? Should it be remembered?
It does quickly become hard.
Exactly.
All the little pieces you have to manage.
Exactly.
Process,
so...
Yeah.
So for my use case, it was use Cognito because then I don't have to build on any of that. So we're not using the SSO concept of being able to log in with another provider is intriguing. But right now it's just, no, we can go into Cognito. Cognito can basically be our user management portal for a really, a really simple idea. Add users there and just the login just works. So where's the Cognito hate coming from? Is it people that want to do more with it, or
I guess it's just the integration. Like I said, I've just heard it. It's been circumstantial. I've just heard it. Read articles, other podcasts that talk about more professional AWS podcasts than ours.
Not the worst AWS podcast.
No, not the worst. That's but us. A little bit more professional than ours. Okay. Cognito is one of those AWS services that people like to hate on. That I think is just how just to kind of just working with it, kind of the rough edges that exist, and it's kind of compared to other providers. Like you have actually interesting. We're looking internally using Okta. Have you ever heard of that?
Have we heard of it? Yes, we have. I'm not sure. Let's see. Is anybody chatting with us? Is Keith on? Keith is our... Oh, no, I've got Jan. Jan from Confu has said hello on LinkedIn. Hey, a while ago, and I missed that. 5 minutes ago. But no, remember Keith Casey apparently drops into our Restream comments and talks about stuff.
Oh, and he works for an authentication or a provider,
well, he works
right?
for a security company now. Yeah. I forget who it was.
Authentication tools.
He used to work for Okta.
Oh, interesting.
So I'm sure he'd have an opinion on...
Maybe we should bring him on. I could actually...
You could just hit him up on LinkedIn. I'm sure he'd be able to tell you everything you need to know. But yeah, Okta, what is it? You got Okta, you got Auth0. What are some of the other ones in that space? Are there other ones in that space? I know Okta's the big one.
There probably are many. Like I said, it's been a little bit of time since I've looked at them, but...
Yeah.
But as you were alluding to, like why, there is a good amount of work that is required to really build your own, all the pieces that are required for your own authentication system for your application when there are other providers that provide the libraries or services that you can kind of plug into. Cognito is the AWS kind of native, authentication service or SSO federated service that you can kind of work into your application. And if you are going to be using, let's say... accounts like AWS accounts. I actually thought it was actually a pretty clean experience doing that. I think maybe it's when you start to link in the other accounts. Like if you want to start to bring in like your Google account, Microsoft, Facebook, Twitter, or X.
Well,
maybe then it starts getting to be a little bit messy with Cognito. But like I said, I have more limited experience with it.
Yeah.
But it's something that a little bit I've done with that, I've had too many issues. Because I do like, it is very easy to get up and running, especially as you talked about from the interfaces. So if you want to have like a login interface,
the hosted UI is just like, it's there. Ready to go.
Forgot your password.
Yeah.
All those screens that you have to build when you roll your own off, that's already done for you.
Yeah.
You just have to plug in the URLs that you want to use for your callbacks and your hooks and the endpoints that you want to use.
No, it was really simple. Just created an application that would get the code, basically an OAuth 2 authentication flow. And we were able to auth the user. But
there are so many things I could talk about. We haven't done this podcast in like 2 weeks, and they're like, that's why I'm like trying to catch myself. It's been a very interesting past 2 weeks. A lot of good, a lot of bad, and it's interesting, a lot that I've learned. And it's...
You just have no idea what you can say. Is that right? Having to balance the you can't talk about what you do.
I've even started working with the Salesforce API. Have you ever thought you'd work with the Salesforce API? And we talked about authentication. That was one thing I was working on this week. It's just basically just authenticating to the Salesforce API so I can start to work with it. And I don't
work with it directly, but yes. Yeah. Yes. I tangentially, I'll say I'm familiar. I'm familiar with the Salesforce.
Which the API is actually, what Salesforce has done with like their, if you just want to get started with it in Postman, the Postman collection they have done is actually pretty nice. Actually, it's pretty well laid out and it's pretty thorough. But it's just something, because we use a lot of Salesforce applications for our customer facing applications. But this is the first time that we do interacting with it from an API standpoint. Traditionally, what we've done is just use AppFlow, which AppFlow is AWS's managed kind of API connector. You can just kind of connect to an API provider that is configured to work with AppFlow.
Okay.
And you can just authenticate the connector, you're good to go. You can pull and push data whenever you need to. So that's primarily how we work with it. But there are some limitations, especially when you need to do request certain types of data, like files or data that you need to pull that's not available in AppFlow. Then you have to start working with the API directly. And so that's been a new process for us.
So AppFlow, the provider has to obviously have an AppFlow configuration.
Correct. Yes, they have to be able to have like a connector, like so that they know how the appropriate connections that the AWS connector makes. That,
okay.
Because when you set up a connector, there are like a list of, there might be ways to do custom connectors, which I haven't taken a look at that yet, but there's a big list of providers that you can set up a connectors with for AppFlow. And once you get it set up, it's pretty nice. It's pretty easy.
Is it, I'm not at all familiar. Is it like a, what is it? Like a Zapier for AWS, kind of like a higher level? Yes. Or Zapier, whatever they want to call themselves.
Is Zapier a, which I've heard of that, but is it more of like an object mapping? So where you specify the objects that you want to map in your API and how that could map to database objects on your platform or...
It's very... So Zapier's very... Zapier's like if this, then that, if you remember them from way back, right?
Yeah.
And I don't even know if
still exists.
If still out there. Is that how you're supposed to say it? If...
IFTTIF or something like
that. Yeah. All right. So however you say that. I feel like it's more in that space for the consumer, which is like, hey, I think sales teams use it all the time. So I get a new lead through this form, through like JotForm, and take the JotForm post, because JotForm will do a webhook when a form's submitted, and then create a lead in HubSpot. And there, yes, it's like an object mapper where you're saying this thing goes to there. But you still are also talking about what operation you want to do. Like you want to do a create because of this.
Yeah, so there are probably, and that's one thing I was going to start to take a look at if they're doing like a custom. You could definitely do that from you could trigger an AppFlow from any, like if you have a Lambda function and then you want to trigger that as part of a, you know, if you have a Lambda as part of a step function, you could probably work that into your orchestration that you're setting up. We just use it basically as just set up our connectors. We do our scheduled jobs. We run these AppFlows to basically just to kind of pull and push data when we need to on a schedule.
So basically go out to Salesforce and slurp up a bunch of data, or go out to some other service and just.
And then once we get that data, then we process it on our end. But there probably are ways if you want to do some additional scripting on top of that, some more logic you want to build into it. There probably is ways, but honestly, like I said, that's kind of, I haven't gone to that extent because my mind always goes, okay, if I want to do something outside of the base functionality of it, then why not just work with the API directly?
Right. So it feels, at least from your use, it feels like it's far more centered around data ingestion and triggers making other things happen, which is the Zapier and the if this then that flow. Okay. So that's why, I guess that makes sense. They're calling it a connector. In that context feels more data.
Yeah, because when we use the connectors from Salesforce, we have processing on the Salesforce end that configures the data that we want to, like the object that we want to get. So we'll do some processing on that end to set up, to establish that object that we want to map to our system then. But basically we're just going, when we set up the connector, we're just mapping the fields that we want to look for, be able to ingest those. And then once we have them in our platform, then we can process the data and do whatever we want with it.
Gotcha. All right, well, sorry, I got distracted by LinkedIn comments.
So interesting, yeah, it's kind of, that was one thing dealing with authentication, talk about the API authentication and bearer tokens, passing those back and forth, which actually it's a pretty straightforward process once you do it a few times, but then making sure you have like the systems, especially the system you're connecting to, if it's an application instance and making sure you have the authenticated, you know, service or whatever settings turned on to make sure you can correctly connect it. That's one thing I was dealing with this week.
I've got, this is the problem with an early podcast. Now I've got children approaching and they don't realize that I'm on a podcast.
Do you need to cook them breakfast? Because it's that early?
No, it's not that early. They've already cooked breakfast, but one of them is insistent and doesn't realize that this is a podcast and I cannot answer any questions. But maybe they do now.
Have them get you some coffee, Tim.
Nah, you see that? Okay, so for you, it's I don't drink coffee. I've tried it so many times.
Do you do any caffeine?
Yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah.
Are you like
oh,
a non-caffeine
person? I'm not a non-caffeine person. I enjoy my caffeine, but I enjoy it cold and carbonated. So I'll tell you where I go for my for my caffeine. Now, I've tried the coffee. I just, and every once in a while I try it again because like someone's like, oh yeah, it's been, we've been working really hard and I had to go get my cup of coffee to keep me going. I'm like, all right, I'll try it again. And it's like, I don't like it at all. Sorry.
It's just a taste thing.
Yeah, yeah. I don't like the bitterness.
The bitterness. Well, what I do, if you don't like the bitterness,
okay.
Because I just drink my coffee black.
Right.
And I would agree with you. I'm not a big fan of dark roasts because they start to get too bitter. And,
okay.
And especially because I just drink it black, and I could drink it with cream and sure, some type of sweetener. I've done that in the past, but actually I have an aversion to cream. A little tiny bit lactose intolerant, so I try to avoid the heavy creams. So that's why I just started drinking my coffee black, and I feel much better just doing that. But what I do now is I grind my own beans, not my own beans, but just beans in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I do the French press. And actually, I find if you actually get good beans, good roasted beans that are like a medium to a light roast.
Okay.
And you use you grind your own, the beans in the morning, make them fresh. It actually isn't better.
Really?
Good quality. Well, if you get good quality coffee, I got like a big bag of beans from Costco.
Oh, boy.
That was like this Mexican, like big bag, like 10-pound bag of beans, right? That you got to get at Costco.
Well, that's the small bag at Costco.
Because I'm buying these 1-pound bags. Like I have a good roaster just down the street from me.
Okay.
And it's really, really good. I do, and I have an online subscription to like a roaster in California that sends me like a couple pounds every month.
You are connected to this coffee thing, yeah? All right,
yeah. So like I'm into it, right? So if you find good roasters to work with and buy beans from, it actually is nice.
So how's the 10 pounds of Costco?
So I was like, I go to Costco, right? Do you go to Costco, Tim?
Okay, so yeah,
you're Sam's Club.
Right? I'm a Sam's Club. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we could talk about that. But so I go to Costco and try to do like a once a week, and I do like, I get like the normal stuff, like the Propel, the bottled waters,
okay,
like the,
yeah,
all the big bulk stuff, like yeah, the paper towels, like right, just very general stuff. That's mostly what I go there for. And I buy it in bulk.
Come home with a
and
chicken?
Come home with a chicken?
Like the rotisserie. Isn't that the big, no? Okay.
Yeah. So I walk through the coffee aisle. I used to, before doing the French pressing, I would do Keurig, right?
Did the little
K-cups and just do that.
Yep.
And I would usually buy like the bulk boxes of K-cups there. And I actually, the Costco branded ones, actually I didn't mind. But then it was like, oh, they had this big 10-pound bag of beans that was like Mexicana, like really, it looked like very, it was like rough. It was like really urban paper. I don't know. It was really cool. And I was it was really bad. Like, and it was only $10. And I was like, man, I'm paying like
a pound. Come on.
For like 2 pounds of coffee, I'm paying like $30 to $40 depending upon where I get it from. So I was like, wow, that's like $10. Like, this is could be a great value here. So I try it.
It was not a great value.
So bad. It was so hard to drink. It was like one of those things. And I have a little bit of,
it's 10 pounds, man.
Like from my past, I have a little bit of like acid reflux issues. I've lost a lot of weight, so like I don't have those as much. But like occasionally, if I eat spicy foods or really acidic foods, I'll still kick it up again. I took one sip of that and I felt like internally, like, that my insides are going to explode. Just, it was so bitter. And so, and I did it when I made the coffee. I made this exact same way. I make the rest of the beans. Like I get very, very specific about this too. I have a scale, like a kitchen scale that I use.
Oh yeah.
So I do 600 or yeah, I'm sorry, 60 grams. Yeah. Like 60 grams of beans. So I measure it out. So I get like an exact amount each time. So I did the exact same way with these Costco beans. And it was like, oh man, it was so bad. Did not drink it. So I just chucked the whole bag. I was so wasteful that I was like, I could not do any more of this.
Plant them out in the backyard.
But what I'm telling you is that if you do get good quality beans and if you do make it fresh, it isn't bitter, but it is still acquired taste. So if you don't like the taste of it, then yeah.
And I guess when you start veering into the coffee flavored things, it's generally more mocha, which is coffee and chocolate, right?
Any syrupy type thing you can add to it.
Right.
Which, yeah,
right.
I tried some flavored beans too, and I don't know. They're okay. I'm afraid that they're cooking up my grinder, so I don't use those as much because they can be quite oily.
Oh yeah. How you'd have to flavor it, right?
Yeah.
To kind of soak it in something. But I don't think I mind like the coffee. It is the bitterness. That's just not my thing. So, but I've tried it. But no, that's not how I get my caffeine. Good show. No, how about the office? How about the office changes?
Oh, the okay. So what I'm down to now, and I think you brought up a good question about the fact of like, okay, now that I'm working from home, I'm not teaching in a classroom anymore. I'm not even teaching online anymore, just only at my desk for at least 8 hours, sometimes 10 to 12 hours. Like, it's been pretty busy a couple of weeks here, and next week's going to be busy too. So it's been a good amount of time in my small little home office. And if you, I don't know if you're watching the video back, I'm basically in like a big closet.
Okay.
You see, like back here, my bedroom, and then I have basically like in a big closet. My big closet has this like this opening here that fits my standing desk perfectly.
Oh, nice.
So it's like a nice area that I have here. And so when I set this up, I said, oh yeah, I had like three monitors going, and I was like, I try to get this as much as flexible as possible. What I've gone down is just one monitor, a very wide as I can get it.
Okay.
And I didn't buy a new one, but like my widest monitor that I had, mm-hmm. I'm just going with one monitor actually, because I find that if I did too many monitors, I got a little distracted and just a little bit too. But I can see this. It was nice, especially if I'm doing like a lot of Teams meetings.
That's
putting one on the other monitor. I do have to switch back and forth, you know. And if you get the desktop switching moving fast back and forth, it can navigate around pretty fast. But it is nice having a second monitor. But when I'm actually, because I've been doing a lot more coding, a lot more development work, I actually just prefer just to work off one monitor then for that. But what you were alluding to is like, I've had thoughts of like, okay, could I just certain hours of the day, could I like, there's a few, like we talked about, there's a few mm-hmm. coffee shops around me that I could just walk to. And I used to love to do that. Like that's, I used to love to get out of the house and go to a coffee shop and work for a couple hours. And I was like, man, if I do that though, I'm just going to work my laptop and I kind of miss my setup here. Also, what I find too, when you're working remotely, you could get pulled into a meeting like, whenever.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody will ping you, ask a question, and then you'll try to correspond, you'll back and forth on Teams
pulled into a meeting means where you're at. You'll chat about, it's not like you're actually pulled into a meeting.
You do a video call.
Yeah.
And like the one thing I don't like, and I can't do myself, is like if I'm like in a coffee shop and trying to be at a meeting, I've tried to do that before. Because I can't, even if I have headphones, if I hear people talking around me, which I love when I go to a coffee shop, I love
the gray noise of all that.
Yeah, I love to work in a public space and be around people because I like being around people. But then when I'm in a meeting, though, and I'm trying to listen to somebody or trying to communicate, I hate that. I hate being like in a loud.
It's a different type of focus, right?
So, yeah. So that's why I'm like, so I get so worried. Like, okay, if I go to a coffee shop, I could probably, I'd be happy working with my laptop. But then, like, man, if I get pulled into a meeting, though, that's like, I don't know. So I don't do this much. I just stay home.
Yeah. Well, that's, and I find that interesting because it's like younger me would have done it completely different. And just like that change of our work habits and how different it gets as, you know, as context around us changes. So,
yeah. But in the future, though, I don't know. I would like to eventually go back in the office for at least 1 or 2 days because there is part of me that misses that. I do miss, like I said, I like being around people. Like, and we are, and the company I work for is pretty cool. We're like, I think everybody, because it's mostly a remote company, mm-hmm. there is a small office in North Carolina that I would say probably about a quarter, maybe a third of the people kind of work around or work out of, but most of the company is remote, and that's the way the company was designed as a remote company. But it would be nice to kind of go back in the office maybe 1 or 2 days a week to kind of meet face to face, because I kind of do miss that.
Now, so that would just mean a move for you as well.
Yeah, so that would be...
You're not just talking about going back to a co-working space or something like that.
Yeah, if I stayed at the company like for a long period of time, and I probably would move closer, probably to North Carolina, because if I want to, if I want to have the type of interaction. Or like they talked about doing is possibly in the future doing like, I think your company does like retreats or once a year get-togethers.
We've occasionally done that for our team. Yeah.
So that's what that may be in the future. That would be fun. I actually would really look forward to that and spending like a, you know, half a week or a week or whatever, wherever, depending on where they want to go. And then kind of, you know, do some stuff with the people you work with. I think that'd be fun.
Yeah. Cause it's from a remote environment. It's nice to see people like outside of that two dimensional. I know it's three dimensional, but it's like, it's a screen, right? Like, to actually interact with people and get to understand a little bit more of how they are, even like physically, like the way that we interact in a real room, then it helps us interact in this kind of virtual space, I think, better. So you get
that's
get
what you use PHP tech for.
Exactly. You know, that's one of the reasons. And well, actually, there'll be some of the team that's going to be at Cascadia PHP next month. It's about a month away. Not a sponsor. Not a sponsor.
I don't know, Tim. I've been here a lot about PHP.
You've been here. Are you
I'm not using it. You talked me out of using PHP in the previous show, so I'm not using it again.
I did. What were you going to use it for again?
We could go back to that. But it's interesting though. I've been hearing a lot about like just developers just talking about PHP again.
Really?
It's kind of like maybe it's Laravel. That's kind of been people are in love with Laravel. That's kind of a thing now that I've been hearing on different podcasts.
Is Laravel around PHP? I didn't realize that. Really? Because I know there's some...
Well, could you be, like, crucified for, like, saying that in, like, the PHP community? Because isn't, like, Laravel, no. like beloved? Or maybe it's just beloved outside the PHP community. Oh, boy.
You could get some interesting opinions. That could be interesting. You could get some interesting opinions is all I will say.
Because, interesting, from my perspective of listening to developers who maybe have done PHP in the past, but they're taking a second look at it because they're hearing it kind of in the podcast, web sphere, whatever, people right. just chatting about it, talking about it. And then Laravel always keeps coming up as like, I think they just had like their Laravel con a couple months ago or something like that.
About a month ago.
So they have some momentum from that. But it's interesting kind of hearing like people who are from developers who are not PHP developers, but used to be, but then think about, look at PHP, how it's grown, how it's evolved. It's actually, if you take a look at it now, it's a pretty good language than it used to be when it was 5.4. Back when 5.3, 5.4?
Those were
good days, Tim.
Hey, I think...
Those are my PHP days.
I want to say, I think I used it even before then, but yes, the five days. And how about PHP 6? That was something
else. No, I left after 4, 5.4.
That was PHP 6 was something else. My reference there was to the fact that some Laravel developers don't even think of themselves as PHP developers.
Oh, interesting.
Because I'm guessing it's the same. I'm guessing it's the same. Like there'd be Rails developers that are Rails developers, and they don't even consider themselves Ruby developers. Like if you just said, "Hey,"
I think they would consider themselves at least Ruby developers, though.
Oh,
I would probably agree with you. Maybe they won't say that they're the Rails developers, but they probably say that they're at least Ruby developers.
There's not those that are so much in the frame. Like they don't even think outside the framework when it comes to Ruby and Rails.
So let's go back. So you're saying that they just consider themselves developers, but they don't call themselves...
No. They consider themselves Laravel developers. They don't consider themselves PHP developers.
Oh, I'm thinking the other way around.
Yeah. So that was when I was, my tongue-in-cheek comment about Laravel being built on PHP is a, like, there's a decent part of that community, at least as far as I understand it, that doesn't necessarily realize there's more beyond it. Or doesn't consider themselves PHP developers, like they wouldn't consider themselves even part of the PHP community, just the Laravel community. And I'm guessing the same is true though of like Ruby on Rails. So there's probably there's probably developers out there that consider themselves, well, I'm a Rails developer, and you'd be like, so you work with Ruby? Like, no, not really. I'm a Rails developer. And it's like, yeah, you do work with Ruby, but you work with that in a very not, I don't want to say narrow constraint, but it's a constraint, and not knowing what else the language may happen to offer. So
that's true. Well, that's the same thing. Like I don't know many Rails developers. I used to, but not anymore.
Right.
Because I'm not in that world.
Is that still a thing?
Oh, it's still a thing.
Still a thing.
Yeah,
okay.
It is.
Okay.
I get a little tempted because I did enjoy it when I was working with it for about 2 to 3 years. I did enjoy it. It was fun. But I haven't had a great desire to go back to it. But what I'm thinking about is what I've seen, though, from what you're talking about. It's like from Next.js.
Oh, okay.
So that would probably be the most equivalent that I come from, saying, like, yes, they're young, especially young developers who, let's say, if Next.js is like the first framework, they learn JavaScript, or they don't even learn JavaScript first. They just learn JavaScript through Next.js.
Right.
Which a lot, maybe that goes back to what you're talking about from Ruby developers, where like they learn Ruby through Ruby on Rails.
Or so. PHP, you learn PHP through Laravel. So
yeah, so you learn it from that context.
Your
and
perspective
that's
is pretty much just this. Yeah. This is the way you do it. It's like, oh, wait, you don't realize there's, you can do so much more. And there's a whole lot beyond this, but that's fine if that's not interesting, appealing, or useful to you. But yeah, so there's Next.js developers that if you just gave them vanilla JavaScript, there'd be... there'd be some problems. Is that what you're saying?
Oh yeah, I would say so. Yeah, ask them to do like their own like asynchronous kind of a promise or some type of async chain. You want to say, okay, let's talk to some APIs and get some data back going back and forth. And then, they probably would fall apart then.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. I think, yeah, the same thing is true in all the different communities. So, but you've got a, you said you had a standing desk there.
Which I'm sitting at now.
Which you're sitting. Okay. Right. So
that's, which, oh, that's interesting too. I thought about this week with the, yeah, my standing desk. I was like, yeah, I have this nice standing desk from IKEA. I love it. And it goes up and down super smooth. Always works. Super heavyweight, durable. It feels like a nice, you know, like a nice desk just feels like,
yeah.
Just, it's substantial, right? Yeah. So it feels like it's, that's, I love this desk, but I don't actually use it as a standing desk anymore because I got this super nice chair.
Oh.
And I was thinking about this because I got this nice chair because I was starting to have some back issues, some like lower back issues. So yeah, I was like, all right, so I got this nice chair. It wasn't a crazy amount of money, but it was like, it was on Amazon, but it was like one of those, like a Japanese chair that, here, like, see, it's like a, I don't know, you can see like the top of it.
There. Yeah.
It's nice, like, nice.
The mesh.
Yeah, mesh kind of all the way around. So it feels like you're floating in air, right? It's kind of one of those chairs. And then I realized, I was like, wow, I don't actually use my standing desk anymore because I'm super comfortable when I'm sitting down. So
for you, it wasn't
kind of a bad thing.
It wasn't the health benefit of standing. It was the, I got to stand because I got to stand.
Okay. No, it did. Your back hurting was a nice reminder of saying, okay, I should probably stand and move around.
Yeah.
So I'd raise the desk, stand for like about, you know, maybe 30, 40 minutes. Because I do find if you start to, like, I can't work from a standing desk for maybe more than like an hour.
Yeah.
Because then I'll get the reverse effect where, like, say my back will start to hurt from just standing too much, or just another part of my body, my legs will hurt or something like that. And then it becomes distracting. Because once you're like trying to work, but you're kind of in pain,
mm-hmm,
I find you're not very productive.
That, you know, yeah, that can hamper productivity. That's for sure.
So, but it was interesting getting this nice chair, which I sit on it at times. It's super comfortable now, and I don't stand as much anymore. I don't use my standing desk. So I should probably force myself to stand once in a while.
So I've shot myself in the foot. I think we've talked about this before with the multiple monitors. Because I don't have a standing desk, but I have a keyboard tray that swings up. So the keyboard tray can pretty much get to standing height. But the problem is, all the monitors, I can't easily... Like, I used to have them on arms, so they can move around, but there's so many of them now, I can't even... Like, they're on arms still, but their arms are where they are. They're not going to move. So for me to actually raise the monitors to be able to work at a standing height is not easy. So kind of next desk change is to get the monitors probably put on the desk and then make the desk able to be moved up or down or something like that.
You just throw some center blocks underneath there. That raises it up pretty. I did that once. Yeah.
Yeah.
Two sets of center blocks, eight center blocks. Yeah. It gives a good height. Outstanding height. Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
It's not quite the same as pressing a button.
It doesn't go up and down that way, but you can definitely get it up there.
Yeah. And I built this desk. So if I wanted this to move, which I might be able to figure that out, there's like hardware you can get for existing desks to turn into standing desks that are pretty nice. Mm-hmm. But that's my next goal for this thing. Have you seen the treadmills?
I have a couple people that it's interesting too that have treadmills, mm-hmm, that they use during when they're so it's interesting when you do big meetings, you see them
and they're just bouncing with their head.
All of a sudden they'll start like walking. Where like, are they walking? How's it happening? What's
going
on?
Bob?
What
are you doing?
Like, that's amazing. I was like, I kind of want one of those, but I'm like, I don't have enough room. Like, that would be something because unless
they're small, like, man, they're small.
Well, you could just kind of push it underneath the desk and pull it out. Is that what the way it works?
The ones that I was kind of poking around at, I think were about the size, like, if you think of the tread of a normal treadmill, right?
Yeah.
Like, the length of that belt, which is, I mean, it's just like a grocery conveyor belt, right? Like, just buy one of them. Just buy one from a surplus grocery store and make some adjustments. But no, they were about, if you think of the size of the tread of a normal treadmill, I feel like they're about half that. Right about half that. So it's like half that size because you're not... I mean, I'm hoping, like, the people you're in a meeting that are walking, it's not like they're jogging, right?
No, they're just walking quickly. But it's interesting. That was the first time seeing it. I was like, wow, this is what working in a real fully remote company is like. Yeah, people, like, they make, they kind of have to work in their workouts or, like, they're getting their steps in
through
the meetings, which totally makes sense. I was like, yeah, I was a little jealous. I was like, I'm not walking right now. I should be walking.
I'm telling you, that's what you need. Get it off of Amazon. It's in my. I've got a couple.
But that's also
let's
talk about. I worked out this morning. My workout schedule. What I do now, because after working myself to running 5 miles last summer and screwing up my knees,
Right.
I don't run as much anymore.
Right.
But I try to do like at least a 15-minute fast incline walk. Like, so I'll get the treadmill, I'll push it up to like, I'll work myself up, you know, maybe like halfway, mm-hmm. like the first like 5 minutes or so, and I'll try to max it out and try to do the max height that it goes, and I'll try to walk as fast as I can for like 15 minutes. And that's a pretty good workout.
Uphill.
And
yeah.
That's kind of an inclined fast walk. And then my knees don't want to, you know, kill me. I don't feel like they're falling apart. And then I do like weight training after that for like 15, 20 minutes after that. And that's usually my workout. So I do some walking. I try to get the steps in with that and also try to walk around town a bit, you know, maybe during the day if I need to, you know, kind of get out. But, yeah, so I don't really have a huge need to walk while I am coding or working. But at least standing more, I should probably stand a bit more.
I need to get to the place where I can do that. But not because my back hurts, because I, like you, have a very comfortable chair.
That's what happens. You buy a comfortable chair because you have back issues, and then you just want to sit in it. So it's like, yeah.
I'm going to say, though, now, you said yours wasn't that expensive. This, you know the chair I have, right? It's so cliche.
No, I don't know the brand.
It's not even... I've got an Aeron.
Oh, you got the Aeron? No, I got like a Japanese generic Aeron. Like, I don't know the name of the company, but it's off of Amazon. It was like about a $300 chair I got on sale. Like, nice. They were doing like a Black Friday, not Black Friday, but like it was a sale. I can't remember when it was. It was sometime over the summer. There was a sale they were running, and I got it for like $160, $180. Mm. And it was like it was also a very weird looking chair too. It was like. It's meshed all over, and then I have to show. It's hard for me to kind of show you because I can't show you. It actually has like around where your lower back is. Like, it's basically like, two panels,
right.
With huge springs behind it.
Right, they give you that lumbar support. Yeah,
and that's why I was drawn to. It was like, oh, because I have like lower back issues, mm-hmm. and if I just had basically two nice soft pads just pushing where I have my pain, that could actually be kind of good. And so it works super well if I have good posture. So if I'm sitting up and not slacking. But what I have found with the way this chair, if I do something like this, start getting lazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Then these pads start getting in weird positions, and then it will create back issues.
And then you're like, no, sit up straight.
My chair does enforce good posture, and I feel like I have really good posture now. But when I do that, because it's super comfortable, but yeah, if I start to sit in weird positions, like I just want to think and kind of slack and just kind of, you know, kind of incline back, you could actually develop back issues with that.
Gotcha. My chair. Gotcha. Now I got a used Aeron. Oh man.
Yeah.
Years ago now. How old's my daughter? So I want to say 14 years ago, maybe. I bought it. The thing was 13 years old because you could tell from, you could tell. So we're developers. We sit in front of a computer a lot, right? You go to Staples and you buy one of those office chairs. How long does it last? Like a year, and then the plastic, seat pan is cracking because it's not meant to be sat in 8 hours a day, you know, 5 days a week, that type of thing. It's not designed for that. So you buy like a $60, even $100 chair from Staples, it lasts you about a year, and then the upholstery's falling apart and something's cracked and you sit down and it like starts poking the leg because, you know, that pan's cracked. You know, we've all sat in that chair, right? So I found a used Aeron because I wasn't ready to spring for what an Aeron costs new.
Yeah, are they like $800, $900
chairs? $900 chair, yeah. Somewhere in there.
I couldn't even do that. Like, I can't justify that. Like for me, I could probably do 3 to 4.
Right.
I could do half that and be fine with it. I was ecstatic when I saw this on sale, that one I got.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah. So.
So I found a used Aeron at a office furniture, you know, place, which is where they go, right? You can tell from the model number, you can know how old the Aeron was. Aerons have, I think, a 10-year or 12-year warranty. I forget what it is. That should say something, right? It's like 12 years manufacturer warranty. They'll replace whatever breaks. So this was out of warranty because it was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. I bought a 13-year-old chair. The thing felt great. There was no real damage on it. I used it for, I think, 5 years, 4 years, something like that. Until finally, so if you think about that, it was 13 plus 4, right? We're talking about 17 years old, somewhere around there. The seat pan finally broke. So I ordered another one. I ordered another seat pan to replace it. Mm-hmm. I actually gave that. My wife uses that for school now. So this thing is almost probably 20, 25 years old, this chair, and it works great. And I bought a new Aeron because I'm like, apparently this chair is going to last for probably the rest of my career. And I know it's comfortable. You know, it's, it's expensive, sure. But like, I'm buying one chair for what I can imagine is the rest of my life.
It's interesting. As you get old, that's what I find too. Like in the past, I would have just, and I could see myself in the future probably buying an Aeron chair myself too. Like if I, for some reason, if I wanted to swap this out for something, if I wanted to upgrade, because I do, as the older I get, as I approach 50, I do find like, yes, I want to buy less, but I don't mind buying, paying more to buy less.
Right.
So to buy high quality, yes. And I'm kind of, in the past when I was in my 20s, 30s, I was like, I don't mind buying something. I probably would do like the mid range, kind of like trying to try and find something like mid range, low to mid range. And then if for brakes, I'll replace it again. But I was like, actually, now I don't want to have as much stuff. I don't want to deal with that. I'd rather just buy something that's really good, high quality. It's going to last for a long time. Yeah. The same way.
And I think probably after that, we kind of realize those things, right? Because it's like after buying that Staples chair, you're like, oh, wait. No, there needs to be something better than this because this thing breaks after every 2 years, right? And then you know. You find it and you find what you like. And again, for me, it was like buy an expensive used chair. And then that says, oh, I guess it is probably worth it. Like on paper, you could look and say it is if it lasts you that long. But sitting in it, saying this worked for 5 years and was already 13 years old. Yeah, I'm going to spring for a new one. So this should be the old developer podcast, the aging geriatric developers.
Well, that's the old guy.
This is the old.
So I wanted to talk to you about, we were talking about buying stuff.
Yeah.
Interesting. Cause we haven't been online for a couple weeks now.
Right.
And I have two new toys, Tim.
Yeah.
And we probably don't have time to talk about both of them, but I'll say what two things I got and then you can tell me which one you talk about.
Okay.
So I have a Synology now.
Oh, awesome.
Synology. Also, I got the Rogue Ally X.
I don't know what that is.
Well, you know what the Steam Deck is.
I know what the Steam Deck is, yes. Yeah.
So the Rogue Ally X is a more powerful, but it's a Windows-based, basically a handheld console, you know, PC console in your hand.
So like an Xbox for your hand, but not Xbox because it's actual Windows.
Yeah, I'll just show it to you right here.
Okay, nice. So it runs Windows?
It just runs Windows. So it's
like real Windows, or is it like a...
Oh, full Windows. Okay. Yeah, and that's what some people have an issue with that. Saying like, okay, they prefer the Steam Deck because Steam Deck uses the Steam OS, and it's a better... You know, if you want a console experience, like a, you know, in your hand, then
oh, like just you go boot it up, you've got apps and stuff, and yeah. Okay, I get what you're saying. Okay.
So it's built, like the OS is built around gaming.
Right.
So if you want to have a window, if you prefer to have... Because the reason I actually prefer to have the Windows... operating system on this because what I do now is I'll use it as my Windows desktop. So I have my MacBook Pro that I use for work and then I use for some strategy gaming, some light gaming, and also just for doing some, you know, some Windows stuff that I want to do, I'll plug it in with the USB-C connection to my dock and it just works perfectly.
Oh, nice.
So I run it as basically my Windows computer now and occasionally just use it for gaming, like on the couch or on the bed or something like that. But so it's interesting that I've been super impressed with it, super happy with it. So what do you want to talk about our remaining time? Synology or the Rogue Ally?
This is tough. This is tough.
And we could pick it up next week then.
And I've got mine's not nearly as interesting, but I finally got myself a 3D mouse.
A 3D mouse?
Yeah. Yeah, we could talk about that. All this stuff. So, all right, let's... 3D mouse. It's for doing CAD and stuff. So we can come back to that. So which one?
So
the Synology. Well, what prompted you have to get the Synology?
Because you've talked in the past about having a use of the Synology.
Yeah.
You have like a NAS. What do you have for your side to have some context on what you have?
I'd have to look at it real quick.
Just a NAS, like a 4 or 5?
Six. I think it's a 6-bay. But let me find out.
So I was previously using the Drobo. I think I mentioned this before to you, and you have no idea what the Drobo
had, is. And I feel like it doesn't exist anymore.
And so, and we were talking about Ruby on Rails developers and people who like the Mac. If I say Drobo, that may, you know, ring a bell.
Okay.
So the Drobo is like a Synology, but it's a NAS device. They made NAS, you know, servers, and they have that more for like desktop based, just like Synology is. So you could, you know, put it above or below your desktop, put like 4 to 6 drives in there, and have like a, you know, a RAID type solution for your office.
Okay.
So I was using Drobo. I've always used Drobo, and it's interesting that people had talked about in the past always had issues with it. And a couple of years ago, they went out of business. So I've been using my Drobo NAS for a good number of years. It's never failed me. I've had some drives fail in it, but I've never had an issue where like it just totally broke and just I lost everything. I've read some horror stories online about people who like once your Drobo dies, like the chips in it, if something burns out or something, or just it gets bricked, then your data is lost because it does use a proprietary RAID format. And if you need to recover your data from there, it could be
a proprietary RAID format.
But it uses like its own format. How it distributes, what I've read about how it distributes the data across the drives. That it does it in a kind of its own kind of unique way and how it distributes RAID. So it's Synology, I think, kind of does something similar. It has like a hybrid, what they call like their hybrid RAID strategy. So they do something similar.
But it's just like whenever someone that to me, that's like not authentic. Well, what do I want to say? Not like authentication, but any security thing. Like if you're talking about, we know how to hash your password. No, you don't. No, you don't. So when you're like, we know how to store data across disks. It's like, do you?
It's true. Well, it was interesting if you just think about like block storage, how data's partitioned and moved between the disk, and how you have like, you know, if you are storing like a video file, it's interesting how you could have like blocks of that video file that could be a one drive, blocks of video file that could be another drive, spread between the drives. So it is interesting. So they do use their proprietary format. So I've read some horror stories how people have lost all their data when their Drobo dies. And so I was worried about that, but I never had an issue with my, if one drive failed, I'd just pop in a new drive. It would just back up. Performance wise, it wasn't the fastest, but it worked. Right. And I could map drives to my Mac or my Windows PC. It was an easy backup solution. I even ran like a Plex media server off of it, or stored all my media on it. So it always worked for me. So essentially I recently, people who know me know I had to move to a new location of a new home. So I wasn't actually using it, and it was one of the last pieces of technology I had to plug in. It's like, okay, let me get this back online. We start to kind of get this in. So I plugged it in, and it was like it started to crunch. It started to have some weird noises. And then it was like, all right, so then I
that's not good.
What's going on?
Crunchiness in hard drives. I feel like that's
a
bad sign.
But the hard drives are spinning. They're working hard when I first boot up, but it wasn't necessarily that. It was actually the fan and the power supply was making noises. It was like starting to get some weird.
Like
and I was like okay, this is. And then I was like, all right, let me just let it go. I'm not going to worry about it right now. I came back the next day. It was, my Drobo was totally off, powered off. And then I turned it back on again, and I was like, okay, so what would happen there? It was like, it wouldn't turn on. And then then finally booted up again. And I was like, I let it go for like the rest of the day. And like I came back halfway through the day. The drives were so hot.
So the fans it was cooling or something.
It was something weird. I was like, oh, okay. Then I started to freak out. I was like, okay, I actually have like all my photos from most of my life stored on this Drobo. You know, a lot of old videos, stuff, a lot of stuff. If I lost it, I would kind of be a little bit sad if I lost a lot of stuff on there. So I was like, okay, I need to start finding another solution. So that's what got me to look for the Synology. But it's interesting too, as they tried to do the migration.
Not a sponsor, because like that whole thing felt like, so I found Synology.
Yeah. Well, because that is probably the most popular, NAS solution. And I've always looked at it. I was like, okay, I'm using the Drobo now. But like I said, the company went out of business. They're not supporting the products anymore. Buy on eBay, if worst case, I probably could go on eBay, find a Drobo and plug my drives into it, and it probably would work. But still, I was like, I don't want to deal with that. So I need to figure out a way to migrate my data off of this to a better NAS solution that's at least as supported. So I got the Synology. I think it's a 4-bay. And so I was like, okay, so I'm going to like migrate my data over to it. So I had to buy like what, a big 16 terabyte drive. So I could move part of my data there. Then I started to kind of slowly start to swap the drives in like, So it took a little bit to move my thing. But the interesting too, if I compare the two systems, Drobo is actually much easier in a sense of like with the drives. Because one thing with Synology that I learned retrospectively, because I probably set this up differently, that if I want to add drives to the volume, right? So if I add that, the first drive you add into the volume, it uses that as like a base size. So once I add additional drives, it has to be that size or larger. With the Drobo, I could just add any size, and it would just kind of work with it. So that was one thing. So once I added that 16 terabyte first drive, I was like, okay, I have to start adding more drives to this. I don't want to start having some redundancy as I'm starting to expand the size, but also for the backup. I had to either add in another 16. I was like, because I only had like 8 terabyte and 10 terabyte drives that I could kind of put in here. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can't do that. I can't add the volumes there. So I should have started with a 10 and then work my way up from there. Because just how the volume system works and how it, you know, starts working. So I find
it's
the Drobo
I think it's a little
bit
how RAID works, and you could probably get away with it if you created another storage pool.
That's what I did.
Oh, okay.
So what I did was I had like I moved most of my data off to that one, which is nice. That thing I did like about the Synology compared to the Drobo is that I could basically set up multiple pools. Mm-hmm. So I did like one drive, one pool.
Yep.
I got most of my data, all the important stuff on that drive, so at least I had it on that drive. And then I built another pool of three drives and then slowly added them up to like, say, you know, 10, 10, 8, and I kind of just worked my way up from there and then moved files back around again and then added that 16 back in the other pool. So it was a little bit of a long process.
Yeah.
I was able to do it. But from a user experience, though, it was kind of a little bit rougher because when I was just working with the Drobo, I could just didn't really care. It mm-hmm. would just I could put a 2 terabyte in there with a 12 terabyte and it would just kind of just work and
right.
as well as I can. So.
I feel anxious just talking about moving data back and forth on drives, and like, dude, I don't know if anybody else is like,
yeah,
data. Don't know. We just believe it's going to be there. So
one program that I am a big fan of. Have you ever used Double Commander?
Double Commander, no.
It's actually I found it on when I was on.
I've
Linux,
used Commander Keen.
Commander Keen, yeah. when I was on Linux desktop for a while, I found this program called Double Commander. Just Google it up.
Double
it up.
Commander, okay.
It's a super nice. So if you think about an interface like an FTP program, so basically mm-hmm. like you have like a UI, basically you have like two panels left and right.
Okay.
And you could set like one drive on one panel, the other another drive on another panel, and then you could have nice moving back and forth. It does a really great job. So if you have to move a lot of files, especially a lot of small files over, and you're worried about, okay, is it going to merge? Like especially if the transfer stops at some point in that process and you need to resume it and you need to like merge files or overwrite files, it has a lot of intelligence built into it. So to say, okay, it'll look for files that were smaller, larger, older.
Right.
It'll give you a little notification saying, do you want to overwrite this or try to merge it or different ways you can work with that. But it's nice if I need to move a lot of data from one place to the next on my through my desktops or these or through my NAS drives that I mounted. That program like that works really, really well. Because if you just use like your, if you're on the Mac, you use the Finder, or on Windows, you use like Windows Explorer. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a crapshoot if it's going to go through or not. You kind of feel also if it dies halfway,
yeah,
you don't know how much actually
like,
got moved over.
Move everything again, I guess, and then say yes.
So
I want to replace.
It's nice. It provides like a nice interface to manage that.
That's nice. Yeah,
it's called Double Commander.
I can see that. I can see that being useful for sure. But no, I've had a Synology for a while. What do I have? I have the DS1618 Plus. So that means I've how many bays is that? 6 bay. So I have a 6 bay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I've got them all filled. They are 4 terabyte drives in each one. So my storage pool total, I guess, is 14 terabytes, which is pretty good. I hover at 16. Or 62% of that right now.
Yeah, probably if I would have bought it again, maybe I should have sprung for the 5 or 6. I did the 4 because I was like, what do I really need? Like, have like more like that. But then I realized retrospectively the way Synology works, especially when it comes to like the backup and expanding the drives and how it likes to have one drive.
Yeah, you like to have one for
you. You really need two drives the same size. Yep. Like when you, so I was like, I probably should have done 6 because
that's
that
not
give
so
me
much
some more
Synology.
Flexibility.
That's like RAID.
Yeah. So I probably should have done more drive bays to give me some more options there. Because when I was trying to move my files and migrate them from the Drobo to Synology, I had to be careful. Like, I had to really plan it out once I realized how I need to stage the sizes of these drives together. So.
Yeah, because I think I'm running RAID 6. So that means I can lose 2 drives and still rebuild it. But that's nice because if you lose 1 drive, you can, you know, you're still backed up. You stick in another drive. I feel like having that extra drive helps it with the rebuild. I don't know. The whole checksum and stuff on RAID is interesting.
Have you ever really lost 2 drives at the same time?
No. But I think it's like having that. I've never really actually lost one in a NAS yet.
I've lost one multiple times.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now you got me nervous because I'm talking about it, man. You know what?
Especially those sound like older drives, too. You're running like 4 terabytes. I don't know.
They're... yeah. They've been there for a while. I don't know. Can I tell when it was created? I don't know if I can tell when it was created, but now you've got me all distracted. But no, the one thing I like about it is they resell, I think, Backblaze as C2.
Mm,
and I just have an automated backup. Mm-hmm. So my NAS is also backed up, and which makes me feel comfortable, but I don't know. I don't know how comfortable I should
feel. Yeah, I would do that for my photos. I probably would do some. I don't know if I'd back up all my movies and videos
I don't
that
have everything
backed up, like that, but photos.